You're listening to Feathers, a podcast of stories about God speaking and his people having just enough faith to believe him and obey. I hope these stories inspire you and encourage you to take flight in your own faith.
I'm your host, Amy Bennett, and this is Season 2, Episode 13. Well, hey guys, and welcome to this week of Feathers. I absolutely cannot believe we are on episode 13. I'm so excited today to have Joy McMillan. Joy actually emailed me after hearing the podcast and thought her story would fit, and I am so glad she did. She is a wonderful storyteller. She was actually born in South Africa, so she has a beautiful accent, and you know how I love to hear accents. We have now had someone born in Scotland, Australia, and now South Africa. So it's just so wonderful to hear voices from across the world share their stories of faith and obedience. So she has quite the story to share today. Her story is really about trusting God with her past and walking in obedience to him to share that with others, even though it could have cost her greatly. So I want to go ahead and jump into that conversation with Joy.
Well, hi, Joy, and welcome to Feathers.
Thanks, Amy. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited that you're here. I would love for you to start out and share with the listeners who you are and a little bit about your family.
Sure. I'm Joy, and I have been married to my hubby for 12 years. We actually just celebrated our anniversary. And he is a state trooper. It's been his dream since he was four, and it's been a reality for the last 8 years, and it's a wild, wonderful life we live. And we have two little ones, not so little actually anymore. Our daughter is 8, and our son is 6, so it's us four, and we have 10 chickens, so it keeps it exciting.
So I would like some chickens, but I was going to say that our neighborhood doesn't allow them, but I just figured out the other week that our neighbor does have one, and I didn't even know it. Like, I heard this, I was walking my dog, and I heard this sound, and I was like, whoa, like, where did that come from? You know, our HOA, I guess, dispersed several years ago, and so kind of anything goes. So, yeah, I guess we have some in our neighborhood, and ours is very, like, suburban, very small lots. Yeah, I would love to have those. So you guys, of course, get eggs and...
We do. We get about one egg every day. Sometimes they take a day off. But so we have a rooster. We just recently acquired a rooster. And man, I don't know what train of thought I was on, but I thought roosters just crowed once in the morning when the sun rose.
Yeah, I never thought about that because I've only heard people complain about it in the morning.
Oh, it's nonstop, nonstop. If we go and close the coop at 11 o'clock at night, Napoleon will crow. It's just, and he's a bantam rooster, so he's really little, hence the name Napoleon. So he's pretty fun.
So we have to, of course, talk about the fact that both of our husbands are state troopers.
Yes.
That's so awesome. And you guys are what state?
Michigan.
Michigan. Okay, so we're down in South Carolina. So it's so interesting, and I love the fact that you, I mean, I'm just putting the math together here. So like the first 4 years of your marriage, you guys, he was not a state trooper, so which is very similar to our story that he had always wanted to be a police officer of some sort, and he did not immediately go into that and then ended up finally applying at all kind of different places. And he has loved it. I mean, he's been doing it now for, I guess, 13 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so it has been a wild ride. But it's kind of funny because I didn't, for a long time, I didn't know him as a police officer. So mm-hmm. I don't know. Of course, that's the same experience you've had. Is it kind of different?
You know, he was working towards it. He, pretty upfront when we were dating, that was the passion. He was actually a mall cop. He was a security guard at a local mall when we met. And actually at the college he was going to, at the University of Michigan, he was also a security guard. And then he moved to security at a hospital. And then he moved to Brinks, where he was an armored courier. Mm-hmm. And so he was definitely making strides in that direction. I knew it was on his radar. But chances were slim that he would get in. Only 2% of the applicants got in. So it was just so miraculous and confirming when he made it through, and he is in his sweet spot.
Isn't it just so wonderful to see that? Like, even people say, are you scared or whatever? I'm like, no, it's so wonderful to see him so happy.
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's, on one hand, it's a choice to not let fear grip you. But on the other,
absolutely.
On the other end, you know, we have friends who, you know, the hubbies are just, their hearts long to do something that ignites their passion and kind of engages their skill set. And so they come home just, you know, and my hubby comes home just, you know, there are days, of course, that he's worn out or he's frustrated because of the way he's been treated. But I mean, he distinctly is doing what he is called to do. And they jokingly call him Reverend at times because he has a pastor's heart. So, you know, his patrol mm-hmm. car is his pulpit and he loves it. He really is in his sweet spot. And I often will respond to people when they say, aren't you fearful? That I firmly believe that, you know, when it's his time to go, he could be a janitor in a teeny tiny town and his occupation doesn't change that time that God says, okay, it's your time to come home. So I cling to that.
Mm-hmm. I do too. He always says it too. He says it's when it's my time to go, it's my time to go. And I always just think, like, even if something were to happen, like, he would be doing something he loved and mm-hmm. he was passionate about. And I don't know, for me, there's some sort of comfort in that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I love that we're talking about you and your husband, because the story you're going to share tonight has to do with your relationship and really about your past and trusting God to be able to, you know, just really have the vulnerability with your husband and to share that in obedience with God to tell you to do that. I hope I'm saying that all
yeah.
right. But, yeah, so I would just love to hear more about that, if you could just take us back to the beginning of your story.
Sure. Well, I was born in South Africa and raised in Namibia, which is the country just northwest of South Africa. So we usually say Southern Africa because no one knows where Namibia is. But raised by amazing parents who still adore each other and just solid believers, always involved in ministry for as long as we can remember. Have an older sister and two younger sisters. But, you know, as it turns out, they were human and imperfect. And raising us out of their own wounding and out of their own brokenness. And, you know, I, as far as I can think back, I struggled to feel like I belonged anywhere within my own family and then within just friends. I struggled to feel feminine, so I hung out a lot with the boys, but obviously didn't fit in there. And I remember just aching to feel like I was a part of something without feeling like I had to pretend, because I got really good at pretending to be somebody. I was not, because I was just desperate to fit in. And my older sister started causing quite a lot of grief for my parents at a young age. And so she was, you know, the self-proclaimed black sheep of the family. And so they were quite busy with her. And then there's 6 years, and younger than me, is my other sister, and then another 3 years. So we're spread over 10 years. And so I think in many ways, we just kind of got lost in the shuffle. And I saw how my older sister broke my parents' heart. And so I think I took it upon myself to work really hard to be the good girl. And to stay out of trouble, to have good grades, to, you know, just control what I could control. But even then, there was still this lingering sense of shame. And, you know, it's hard to put your finger on it as a child. You don't have words for it. You just know that something's not right. And there was a really hyper-sexualized relationship between my older sister and I. And didn't know where that came from. You know, we had great parents who, you know, they were careful about who we hung out with within our house. And so just didn't understand where that could have come from, and carried a lot of shame, thinking that something was intrinsically broken in me, that my sister and I had this really unhealthy relationship as young girls, as little girls. And then as we grew up, we both were very promiscuous. But it's interesting because, you know, when you grow up in a Christian home, there's this holy grail of virginity. And I understood a lot of the law aspect of faith. There was, you know, we had solid religion. I had a lot of head knowledge. but I really didn't know Jesus, and I really didn't understand grace. And so it was very much just going through the motions. And so as I started to hit puberty, I remember I started very young, started my period really young, felt awkward because none of the girls were hitting puberty at the same age as I was. Mm-hmm. And had very unusual boundaries, which is complete lack thereof. I remember hitting puberty, and because I hung out with the boys, you know, it was my response to it was, hey, guys, look at this. I'm growing boobs. Do you want to look? You want to see? There was just such a lack of boundaries and such an unhealthy fleshing out of what life was like in these turbulent years of puberty. And I was the girl in what would have been middle school. We don't have middle school in where I'm from, but, you know, during those years, I would be the girl making out with the boys and just so consumed with being that girl and yet not crossing that line. You know, that was the untouchable thing. You don't have, mm-hmm. you don't have sex. And it was very much I was fearful that if that happened, then I would be smited and God would hate me. And so I would toe the line and push it, but there was always this, okay, no, this line is in the sand. And, so I think that built up some of the shame, and it just compounded it because I knew I was not making good choices. We didn't have a drinking age back home. And so my sister and I would go out to the bar when I was 15 and she was 16 and go home, you know, just hang out with boys we didn't really know, but always drawing that line, you know, chickening out at the end. Okay, no, I can't do this. And so we moved to the States when I was 13 and then back home when I was 15. So I went to four different high schools, which is a surefire way to royally mess up a teenager. Just when you start to settle in, you know, you're uprooted and here you get to be the new kid again. And 2 months after I turned 15, I found myself at the home of these boys, these sons of one of my dad's coworkers, and they spiked everything that I drank. I was there with a friend, and the younger brother took me downstairs, and the last thing I knew was I had just had sex and had very little say in it. It was very blurry, and it just felt like my heart had been turned inside out. I went home, and because I knew my older sister was the black sheep, and she was experienced in these things, I remember rolling up in the fetal position and walking, saying, I'm not a virgin, I'm not a virgin, I'm not a virgin, because I knew she was a safe place for me. Just for that one night, her and I did not like each other in teenagers, but for that night, she was the only person I could go to. And something shifted in me after that, because suddenly what I had been holding on to, what had been that line in the sand, had been blurred, and there was no reason to say no. And I think I just believed that God had written me off. You know, I had messed up, and now it was a waste. And so, you know, any time a boy said, hey, you know, want to go home with me? I would say, sure. You know, if he would hold my hand and make me feel loved, even though, you know, in hindsight, I know it wasn't love, I'd say, sure. And so I was 15 years old and traipsing around town with boys and men much older than myself and just slipping further and further into this lonely place, because at the same time this was happening on the weekends, I was a great student and a good kid, and, you know, I was charming with my parents' friends, and so I would show up at church on Sunday and smile at the pastor and hope that he would not see through my, you know, masquerade.
So did your parents know or have any clue what was going
on?
They
had no idea. I was the angel child and my older sister was the black sheep. And you know, I think my parents started to catch on that I wasn't all they thought I was when they discovered that I had stolen money from their bank account. I had been taking money from their closet, that they had bought money home from the States. And so they had this American money, and, you know, it started small. It always starts small. And when I got away with that, I took more, and that became an obsession. I became a fully blown kleptomaniac. And so, if anyone knew me back during that time, I apologize. I probably stole something from you. And, you know, God has been sweet because I have been able to actually go back to people, to cousins, to people that I knew and confess that and make it right. And God has been so sweet to actually bring amazing conversation out of those mortifying moments. But so they discovered that I had stolen money from them and went to try and get hold of me, and I was not at the girlfriend's house that I said I was going to be, and they found me at the boyfriend's house the next morning. So I think they started to catch on that there was a problem. And I had tried to do correspondence when we moved back to Namibia. I had begged my parents to let me do correspondence schooling because I did not want to go to another school.
And well, tell me what that is. For some reason, I don't know what that means.
It would basically be I would be taking myself through computer program schooling. So I would be doing classes at home, like a self-guided schooling. And it would have been my junior year. And I think my mom realized, I remember her saying to me, I was 15 at the time, she said that the devil finds work for idle hands. And I didn't understand what that meant, but, you know, I was very idle. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. I had all this time, and so I'd walk into town, and I became an expert shoplifter. And they had no clue. I was so excellent at putting on a, you know, a facade. And so this was all within a year. We fondly refer to it as my bad year. But of course, it was not just in one year. But it was miserable. And, you know, I didn't go around looking for a good time. I think, you know, as a mom looking back at my 15-year-old self, I had such broken self-image and no self-worth that there was just no reason to say no. It certainly wasn't an enjoyable thing for me. You know, I was just a vacant body. I had become so good at making my body numb and just emotionally checking out. I would be present physically with whoever I was with, but I just checked out because that was my coping mechanism, because I knew I was doing things I shouldn't have. And had no sense of, there was no spiritual activity on the radar. You know, I think the greatest exchanges I had with God was in grocery store bathrooms where I was taking pregnancy tests I had stolen, saying, God, please, if you don't let me be pregnant, I will stop doing this. And so that was 15. And then we moved back to the States just after I turned 16. And on our way through, we stopped off in Cape Town in South Africa because that's where all our family is in South Africa. And I was in a car accident. I was with a guy who was driving drunk, and my cousin and another guy. And there was stuff that went on that followed a drunken evening, and he was angry. And so he said, let's get in the car, and he drove. And we were driving down a main street in Cape Town, and a taxi pulled up in front of us. And then we broadsided it. And so I broke my face.
I
broke my jaw in two places. And so they had to wire it shut. And then we flew back to the States. So I've got 6 weeks with my jaw wired shut. And, continued a relationship that I started that night, the night that I was in the car accident, a long distance relationship for 2.5 years.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
And very interesting. I was 16. He was 21. We ended up getting engaged when I was 18. And it was so odd because, you know, we moved to the States and God started to kind of tug on my heart because it was a new start. You know, there was this sense of, well, nobody over here on this side of the country knows what I've done. And so I get a clean slate. You know, it was my senior year. I was so excited to be able to kind of leave that behind and try and get my life right. With new connections and new friendships and healthier surroundings. And so, again, I just got really good at pretending that I was who I desperately wanted to be, and almost mentally buried everything that I had done. That whole previous year, I just kind of dug out in my mind a cavity in the earth and buried everything in there and covered it up and just decided I would move forward as if none of it happened.
And because you really hadn't been caught much at this point, right?
Oh, not at all. I had never been caught for shoplifting. And
so this is just your secret.
Oh, absolutely. I was an expert secret keeper. No, my parents had no idea that I wasn't a virgin. They didn't know I'd been sleeping around. They didn't know that I had stolen money or anything from anyone other than them, which probably isn't super uncommon.
So I'm just wondering, you had been raised in a Christian home. I mean, would you say you're a believer at this time, and are you feeling conviction for this, or just because you knew the
religious right and wrong things, you knew you had to hide it.
I would say that, you know, I had given my life to the Lord at a young age. My dad has a saying, which I have claimed as my own, that I basically met Jesus through my mother's milk. It was just, there was no kind of mega salvation moment. It was just, you know, this, I knew the Lord from a young age, but I knew about the Lord. So I really don't believe that there had been any type of serious, I know Jesus. I may have prayed a prayer, not to say that that's not significant, but there really wasn't a genuine tugging. I knew that I was breaking rules and I was not a good person. I think that that was really the guilt and the condemnation. And the enemy just had a heyday with me. But I got so good at numbing and at silencing that voice, and just convincing myself that it was too late and he didn't, you know, God had fired me essentially. And to numb the pain, I just kept filling it with relationships and pornography and just everything I could find that would temporarily numb the ache of the fact that I knew I was such a rotten person and didn't know how to change it. So, but I think when I was removed from everything that I was doing and there was almost silence, there was a void created. I felt like there was an ability to sense, okay, God is calling me. There's a fresh start. But I think it was, even at that time, it was very fleshly. Like, I can have a clean slate. I can try harder. I can be a new person. Mm-hmm. Very much a self-effort versus really understanding grace. Like, I can have a fresh start in Christ. It was very much, I can make for myself a fresh start. So I really only started to press in spiritually to the Lord when that engagement fell apart. I was 18, and I had told him basically, we shouldn't be sleeping together anymore, which, you know, to tell a non-believer who's really not interested in purity that he should marry you and that you should not have sex is not very popular. And so he broke up with me and left me with a ring because he would come in. His father was quite wealthy, and he would fly over and stay for a month with our family and then go back home, and then he would fly out. So we had this very fragmented relationship for 2.5 years, but then he broke up with me, and I was just shattered because I thought this is the only person who was going to love me and have me and tolerate me. While he didn't know anything really about life before him, I think I just resigned myself to the fact that God was going to punish me for the way I had behaved. And so now that this guy was off the radar, I was going to die a miserable, lonely life. And so when he broke up with me, God is so sneaky. We like to refer to him as Jehovah Sneaky. That very week that my world fell apart, the women's group that my mom was leading was going to a conference, and I was just desperate and lonely enough to go with them to hang out with all these old ladies. And they were such a godsend to me. They just were mamas for me. They just loved me where I was. They helped me, you know, start to see myself the way the Lord saw me. He started to woo my heart. You know, and he's such a gentleman. He doesn't force stuff out of our hands.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't unlock those closets for us. He started to woo me. And so I really pressed hard into him, but I fiercely protected my baggage. You know, that stuff, besides pretending it didn't happen, the stuff that would haunt me, I just stuffed. I got so good at stuffing it. In fact, I would wake up with cold sweats from having nightmares that I had been a part of a murder that had been covered up. And I have to wonder whether, because I had almost lost touch with reality of what I had done and what I hadn't done, that I was giving the enemy the perfect opportunity to really mess with me, because I'd almost convinced myself I hadn't done half the things I had done. And
you didn't even know the truth anymore.
No. So I was very vulnerable to him because, you know, things that are in secret are basically, you know, the devil's playground, but when they come out into the light, they lose their power. And so I had them under lock and key. And for 7 years, I had this,
wow,
this little performance down pat. And it just got, you know, as I pressed into the Lord, you would think that it would have kind of naturally emerged, but it really didn't. I almost just got better at performing because now I had the Christian performance down. You know, I was working at a Christian radio station, and I was leading youth group, and I was leading Bible studies. So again, this head knowledge, so much head knowledge, but not allowing the Lord to actually heal my heart. It was very performance-y, very, you know, going through the motions, truly seeking the Lord and loving Him and feeling His love, but just not allowing Him there. So, it was hard because it felt like I was dragging, you know, 1,000 pounds of dead bodies behind me, all this lifeless baggage behind me, and it's like I got so used to carrying it, it was just always there. I didn't know what freedom felt like.
No, I can't imagine. I'm just thinking, it just brings back so many memories. I don't know if you know part of my story, but I had an emotional affair about 10 years ago, and it was one of those things where nobody knew until my husband confronted me just with questions about it. But during that time when nobody knew, it wasn't a very long span of time, but it was the worst anxiety I'd ever had. I was fearful. I was not eating right. I knew I was doing wrong. And just the weight of that and being fearful of people finding out, all of that was just, I'm just trying to imagine that going on kind of for 7 years, and I don't know. That would be super hard.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure how I thought I would continue to live that way. I think when you've lived that way for so long, it almost becomes your new normal.
Right.
I recently, a few years ago, I was drawn to Proverbs 27:7 that says the man who is full loathes honey, but to one who is hungry, even what is bitter tastes sweet. And I think those years were so bitter for me, which I think too explains why I tolerated what I did and what I exposed my heart to, because just anything, I was so hungry for validation and so hungry for even counterfeit affection that I just accepted it all. And almost, you know, after 3 years of being celibate, almost fell right back into it. God was so gracious to me. Our family went back to South Africa right after the new millennium. And I went back, you know, like, yay, I'm a youth leader. My life's all together. And before I knew it, I was intoxicated and in a hotel room with a guy I had just met, and felt sick to my stomach. But God just intervened, and nothing happened that night. And I don't know how to explain it, but God just intervened and put the kibosh on something that could have really kind of sent me into a really unhealthy spiral. But it was like he used it as a wake-up call that you cannot pretend you've uprooted this stuff, because you haven't. And so the moment you give it the right environment, it's just going to sprout back up again. And so I had a bit of a scare that, wow, this stuff is still there, and it's still very real. And when I was 21, so quite a few years after this breakup, when I was working at the radio station, I met this guy who was just so unlike all the other guys I ever dated. I had committed to the Lord that I was not going to see anyone except for this one rendezvous in the hotel room. I was not going to see anyone because I had proven to myself that I was not good at guarding my heart, and that I needed him to do that for me. And so I basically gave my heart to the Lord and said, you need to let me know when the right one comes along. And so I met this amazing godly guy who just knocked my socks off. And to make a long story short, realized that if he knew who I truly was, that he would head for the hills. And so I was very intentional in sharing with him just the poor me part, that, you know, I was date raped by this guy. It wasn't even a date, but however one would explain acquaintance intoxication situation, and that it was out of my control. And so I come with baggage, and I thought, well, as long as he knows that I'm not a virgin and that I come with baggage, this should be okay. I should be good. And then we started dating, and I just kept everything quiet, hoping that, you know, it would just go away. And then 2 months before we got married, I was out in New York at an event, and I had my media pass around my neck, and I was sitting up front and was just, you know, the bee's knees, listening to Toby Mac and hobnobbing with Michael W. Smith. And so they moved off the stage, and this lady came on who was a purity advocate, Pam Stenzel. And she started sharing about how when you get married, it's important to live with full disclosure and to build a relationship on honesty and integrity. And I just wanted the earth to swallow me whole because I was getting married in 2 months and I was a complete farce. And just felt sick. Honestly felt like, God, if you just took me home right now, that would be fantastic because I'm not sure what to do from this point on. I didn't feel like I could bring it out because I had lied to him for the extent of our relationship. But if I kept it quiet, I knew it would suffocate my soul. And so I basically made a deal. I said, God, if you can get me up to Pam and she tells me I have to do it, then I will do it. And I thought, well, I've kind of I think I'm going to win this one because people just flooded the prayer tent. You know, we're so wounded sexually. While we don't talk about it, so many of us carry wounds. And so I stood on the kind of the periphery and thought, well, it's so full and I'll never get to her. And I turned around to walk away and she was standing behind me. And so Jehovah Sneaky totally pulled over on me. And so she prayed with me and, you know, she agreed. She said, yes, you need to build this relationship on full disclosure. And I just felt like God was saying, I'm giving you the opportunity of a lifetime, but you have to act within the lifetime of this opportunity. And there was such a heavy burden on my heart that I needed to come clean. I needed to trust that what God was asking me to do was going to be good in the long run, even if it meant my world fell apart again. And was I willing to trust him with my brokenness? So I drove home from New York to Michigan the next day and went to the apartment that he was at and basically just poured out my heart. I could not look at him in the eyes. I felt like I felt physically dirty, like the filth of who I really was kind of leaking through my pores. And if he looked at me, he would have seen, you know, this is like I had taken off the mask and here was the ugliness sitting in front of him. And it took me a long time to get the words out of my mouth because there was so much shame and so much guilt and so much self-loathing. You know, I really hated who I had been and I hated what I had done to him by not being honest. And so he asked me what I dreaded he would ask me and said, how many have there been? And I told him and took off the ring and sought solace in the bathroom, crawled up in the fetal position and again just hoped that life would end because, you know, here we go again. I had just lost him. And this was so embarrassed and so ashamed. And I do not know how long, you know, I have no concept of time for this evening. It was the longest night of my life. But he eventually walked into the bathroom and kind of pulled me up off the floor and forced me to look at him. He actually had to hold my chin up with his hands. And he said, look at me until I actually, for the first time that evening, put my eyes on his eyeballs. And then he got down on his knee and he said, will you marry me? Mm-hmm. And that to me was probably the most incredible God encounter I've had in my life because it's like suddenly, bam, there's the gospel. You know,
I was going to say, that is such a picture of the gospel. That is beautiful.
Oh, it just wrecked me because here he knew the ugly and he knew the broken and he knew the sin. And he wanted me anyway. And I, you know, I'd love to say it was easy after that to walk through, you know, the stuff we had to walk through. But he was so wise. You know, I think he kept his distance because he was reeling. He didn't quite know what to do, but I think it was supernatural that he was able to say that night and to invite me back into relationship after I had severed his trust. And so he actually went to his mentor the next day and said, who's an older, wiser man, just an incredible man, and said, what do I do? What do I do with this? You know, she's not who I thought she was. She's lied to me. I feel angry. I feel resentful. You know, he basically processed everything that he was able to so early on. And this man said to him, you know, it took a lot of bravery and courage for her to come to you. You are not pure. You may be a virgin, but you have got your own stuff that you've walked through. You guys deal with this and you never bring it up again. And it's amazing to think that we've been married for 12 years and never has it been a tool that he's beaten me over the head with or ammunition that he's fired at me.
That's so beautiful.
He's been so gracious. And you know, it's interesting too because 7 years of secrets of being such an expert at wearing a mask and pretending after I shared that with him, it was as if something in my spirit shifted, because the next morning I crawled up on my mom's lap and I told her. And it was like this. I had this crazy courage of, oh my goodness, I didn't die. He didn't hate me. I didn't, you know, and so I shared it with my mom, and my mom wept with me because, you know, as a mom, she feels, how did I miss this? You know,
right.
You know, and a lot of the stuff didn't come up yet. You know, it took years for us to really dig deep and talk about, you know, the other addictions that happened. But she knew, you know, she had an idea of what I had walked through. And she said, would you share this with our women's group? And I said, yes. And so, you know, as I started to share this thing that I thought I would take to the grave with me, that had been such a source of heartache and shame, suddenly became something that I was so passionate about, because, you know, as I bravely stepped up and shared, you know, this raw story of brokenness, you know, women would seek me out afterwards in tears and say, me too. And so suddenly there was this, wow, you know, this very thing that the enemy tried to destroy me with, God is weaving together as, you know, my primary ministry to love on women who have walked through this. And so it's been a long, long road. You know, I brought a lot of baggage into marriage, and my hubby has been very gracious and very patient with me. I've had to learn to emotionally check back in to intimacy, because I was so good at being numb and being absent. And so, you know, while there was grace and while there was forgiveness, we've had to walk through the consequences. But even in that, God's been good.
So I want to just go back just for a minute. So you encountered the woman who prayed for you and really felt that call to talk to him. And, you know, we talk on this podcast a lot about just obedience and having the faith and the trust in God to trust that the things that he's telling us to do, that we can do them and we can trust him. So I just wonder if you go back to that, you know, that time in between where you knew you should tell and to the time that you actually went. Now, was that just between, it was just the drive? I mean, I'm just wondering what gave you the actual courage then to talk to him? I mean, was there any scripture that came to mind? I mean, do you think it was just a Holy Spirit empowering to be able to do that? Like, what do you think made the difference for you to be able to step out in faith?
I think it was a combination of feeling the urgency that I had 2 months, and if I wasn't going to do it now, I wasn't sure if I was going to do it. And so there was definitely an urgency in my spirit. There was a conviction that I have to do this. But, you know, God was so good, too, in allowing completely by, you know, there's no such thing as coincidence, but I had invited a friend to go with me on this trip, and she was actually a friend of my hubby's before she was a friend of mine, and she was there with me. And so as we went back to the hotel that night, because we had a night before I made the drive back, I shared it with her, and it was the first time I had articulated all of this junk. I just poured out my heart to her, other than, you know, the nutshell version I had shared with Pam Stinsall that day. And she prayed with me. She is a prayer warrior, and I really think even just that little shot of, oh my goodness, she knows now who I am, and she is fiercely protective of this man I'm about to marry, and she still loves me. I think just that encouragement of, oh, somebody knows, I'm semi-exposed and I have not been shunned, and she's going to pray me through this. And so there was very much a support. And it was a scripture verse that actually still is one of my absolute favorites that I go back to over and over again. Let me find it. It's Isaiah 43. It's a long one, so I'll just give you some of the nuggets that I've underlined and stood out to me. But I was very fearful of how he would respond and what would happen. And so Isaiah 43 says, "Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze." And then it hops on down to 4, "Since you are precious and honored in my sight, and because I love you." And then if you scooch all the way down to 18, "I clung to this. Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I'm making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland." And my life certainly felt like a wasteland. So that is something that I stood on and clung to and read a lot, and God was faithful. He was so faithful too, because, you know, it doesn't say if you walk through the water and if you walk through the fire. There's a distinct when, and we did have to. I personally had to walk through it, or chose to, you know, to be obedient, although I didn't feel like it was too much of a choice. It was life or death,
right.
And I chose life.
Oh, man, I get tears in my eyes as you read that. I mean, just how much God loves us, like, no matter what. Like, he has so much grace for us. And I think that's why, you know, he always uses our brokenness to speak to people, right? Just to that's where we can connect. That's the Me Too. And it just communicates, you know, if God can love her for that, then maybe he can love me for my junk too. Mm. In spite of my junk too, maybe because of my junk too, you know? Mm. So I think it's so powerful, and it's just like God to use the stuff that you don't want to talk about, to minister to other people, but it is so powerful. It's so powerful to hear when you've been through stuff like that, and yet God loves you anyway, because he is such a gracious God. And I love when you were talking earlier about how he's such a gentleman, how God is such a gentleman, that he doesn't push. And he says, here's your opportunity. He hands it out and says, here's your opportunity to do the right thing, to get closer to me. And, you know, we have to make a choice. It really is a choice. But we can trust him that we can go, you know, we can walk closer to him, and he'll carry us through it all, because he is so loving and he loves us so much. So it's so clear in your story. I love it.
Thank you. You know, it was certainly hard to walk into that fire and to walk through that fire. But, you know, I think what hurt more was having that fire alone in my past and in my baggage and in the secrets. I mean, that was so uncomfortable. And I look back thinking, you could not pay me enough to live another day in the darkness that I lived for so long. And so I think that's what lights a passion in me, to really encourage vulnerability and authenticity and transparency, because, you know, the stuff that we hide, you know, God is so good to make beauty out of our ashes. But I think the enemy has us so duped that, you know, if we share our ashes, we will be rejected or we will be shunned. And so we keep them quiet. And I think how many stories, how many testimonies, how many ministries are kept silent because we are too fearful to trust that God can make beautiful things even out of our junk, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's so true. I have found that people are so gracious because, I mean, we're all kind of a mess, right? We all have, it may not be the same mess, but we all have a mess. And I have found that people are so gracious because, you know, we're all kind of the same at the end of the day, sort of a mess. So thank you so much for sharing your story and being vulnerable and transparent today.
You're so welcome. Thank you for listening.
So if people want to connect with you maybe online, is there a good way for them to do that?
Yeah, I have a website called simplybloom.org. Bloom as in the flower, not blue the color. Simplybloom.org. And that is, there's a Facebook page too, Facebook.com/simplybloom. And I'm on Instagram, but all of those links are right through Simply Bloom. And I have a store, Simply Bloom Shop. .org, where actually I have a book where I wrote this whole juicy testimony in, and it just amazes me how people will email me and say, this is my story. So
that's amazing.
It's been fun.
Yes, definitely check that out. Well, thanks again for being here today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It's just such a beautiful picture of the gospel, of her putting herself out there to her fiancé, and him accepting her with the good and the bad, and how he's been so faithful to her through the years. And the one part that really sticks out to me is when she felt like God was saying, I'm giving you the opportunity of a lifetime, but you have to act within the lifetime of this opportunity. And I think that is so true sometimes, that God offers us opportunities out to us. And, you know, maybe sometimes we miss them if we don't act. If we don't ever step out in faith, we might miss it. And I think of the rich young ruler who was offered so much more from Jesus, and he walked away. So I'm just praying for all of us that we recognize these calls, and just like Joy did, that we trust him, even if it might cost us, that we would go ahead and step out. But just to see how God has used that for her for such good is so encouraging.
All right. So you can hop over to featherspodcast.com if you want to get the show notes or leave a comment for Joy. If you really connected with her story, you can link over to her book from there. So I hope you guys are having a great week, and we will see you next time on Feathers.